Hi, this is Elmore Leonard. I'm listening to film sociology, and it's a real program. It's great.
It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the multiplexes and at the art house.
Warehouse, farmhouse, hen house, outhouse, or doghouse in that area.
You'll also hear about new and old films on Blu-ray and on DVD. Plus, you'll hear all the latest Hollywood gossip.
I don't care!
Okay, maybe not the latter, but it is time for Film Sociology with WFYI's film guru.
Kaiser Shizzy!
No, that's Matthew Sosi.
It's such a fine line between stupid and clever, yes.
Let's see how thin the line is. Here's your host, Matthew Sosi.
Film lovers, welcome to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD to the Point and WFYI.org. If you have a question or comment, you can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook, also on Twitter, at Matthew Sosi. The show is available as a podcast, and it's also available on iTunes. Big and busy show today. Film sociology correspondent McKenna Mays spoke with Aaron Hens and Adam Allen, who are involved with Nickel Plate Theater and the Indiana Theater Company's production of The Mask We Wear, which is happening up at the Cat in Carmel on the 16th and 17th of March. That's, of course, 254 First Street. And I spoke recently with Johanna Bloom and Brian Corbin of the Eideljorg. The Eideljorg exhibit, The Real West, a bunch of really cool Western memorabilia at the Eideljorg, opened last week. And so I'm going to play those a little bit. But the plight of having a show on the weekends it comes into fruition this past week. The Academy Awards were almost a week ago, so what you should know the winners by now. How did my ballot go? I got 16 out of 24, got Best Picture wrong, but that's okay because I really enjoyed Shape of Water, and not just because film sociology guest Doug Jones was a part of this program, but there's a number of films that will hopefully get a wider audience for curiosity's sake, and smaller films, whether they're documentaries or foreign language films. Will hopefully get a larger audience and get spread out more through the country. And that's already happening because the Chilean film, which won Best Foreign Language Film, A Fantastic Woman, is opening in theaters this weekend in Indianapolis. A complex drama about the lover of a businessman, well-known businessman, who the businessman passes away. Family does not want the lover, who is transgender, to attend the funeral and really wants to kind of pay the lover off and send her on her way, or as they would put it, send him on his way. Very complicated story as far as what the lover can do and the narrow-mindedness of what the family wants to do. Hopefully this isn't going to be remade and dumbed down in the United States. But I can see where it won. I picked The Square. And full disclosure, that's the only one of the five films that were up for foreign language films that I saw. So hopefully we get more foreign language films in our fair city and screened in advance so we can have a better beam on that category. Most of the films that are out, I mean, that are up for awards or won awards are in theaters now. I mean, most of them, and if they're not, they're already out on video. So hopefully a film like Call Me By Your Name and Phantom Thread, obviously Shape of Water will get a boost. Three Billboards will get a boost. I, Tonya will get a boost. More people will rent, hopefully get out and check it out for curiosity's sake because of the screenplay. So we'll see. We'll see about that. And it's about damn time Roger Deakins finally got one. I get excited when one of my favorite cinematographers finally gets one after 14 nominations. And James Ivory finally getting one. I think he's at the age of 90 for the screenplay adapted screenplay of Call Me By Your Name. So congrats to everybody. Fun evening. There's only two award show I watch, so I don't care how long it goes, so long as it's entertaining to me. Anyway, so Fantastic Woman's worth checking out. Another film, now that we're in the post-Oscar whatever, The Party from Sally Potter, writer and director. Here's the cast of heavyweights. Kristen Scott Thomas, Patricia Clarkson, Bruno Ganz, Cherry Jones, Cillian Murphy, and Emily Mortimer, and Timothy Spall. And it's a dinner party to celebrate Kristen Scott Thomas's election and her new job, and everybody comes into the party with big ol' issues. They're magazine racks. They're filled with issues. And I think as an American audience member, as an American film goer, we're expecting verbal and physical Virginia beyond Virginia Woolf. If you were to combine Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf with Thunderdome, and much of the film's credit, it gets close intentionally without having to get into a full blown battle royal. So solid acting from everybody. Secrets are revealed, and in a very uncomfortable way, some more uncomfortable than others. Announcements. Reactions from those announcements, but it doesn't quite go over the top. So, and that's a good thing. That's a compliment. So, it's the calm before the storm, or the rumbling before the storm. And I think we're probably used to having a full blown ridiculous storm, and we get what happens right before it. So, good call. So, check it out. Okay, as I mentioned, a number of the Oscar-nominated films and winners are out on video. Lady Bird came out this week. Don't forget, at IU Cinema, tomorrow they are showing In Between, as well as The Abyss at 6:30 p.m., St. Louis Blues at 7 p.m. on Monday, and Tuesday the 20th, Funkology, A Conversation with Bootsy Collins and Dr. Scott Brown at 5 o'clock. Next Saturday, Robert Altman's Three Women and the fabulous Cassie Lemon's film Eve's Bayou at 7 p.m. Three Women is at 3 p.m. And at the Historic Artcraft Theater next Friday and Saturday at 2 and 7:30 p.m., Anatomy of a Murder, Jimmy Stewart, Lee Remick, Ben Gazzara, Eve Arden, George C. Scott. Brilliant soundtrack by Duke Ellington. So it's worth the trip down to Franklin. Okay, so here is film sociology correspondent McKenna Mays talking with Aaron Hens and Adam Allen about The Mask We Wear. Enjoy!
So how did the Indiana Theater Company get started?
Well, it actually started several years ago as Nickel Plate Players. Ashton Wolf, who wasn't able to be here today, and his wife Sandy Thorne created a company that wanted to focus on original and lesser known productions. They had a couple of original productions. They did do one book show in 2014 called Beehive, and it's based out of Fishers, or it was at the time, and they essentially sold out the Fishers Amphitheater for that. So they then started doing about a show a year, and we got involved. I got involved a couple years ago with the it was called Indiana the Musical, and it was commissioned by the Bicentennial Commission when everybody was going bicentennial crazy. And it's actually kind of a funny story. Ashton, the artistic director, and I worked on a commercial shoot, and that summer, which would have been 2016, and a couple months later, we were in the waiting room for an audition for another commercial, and he came up and approached me, and basically, this show had it had done several venues over the summer, and it got picked up for another show in the fall, and a lot of the actors that were available originally couldn't do. I replaced somebody that was on a cruise, I think, and so I ended up getting involved there. Did that show. We bonded about, wanting to create this professional vision. And I started on the board of directors that winter and got involved with all the shows the following season. And then we did a show called Ten Pin Alley the summer of 2017. Mm-hmm. And that was when I brought Adam on board. We had worked together like 8 years ago in Shelbyville. I think I was 23 and you were 14, 15,
I was like a freshman
something
in
like
high
that.
School, yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, as rehearsals go, we would, you know, usually stay afterwards and kind of talk shop. And we ended up having some pretty late nights talking about, you know, the future of the company. And we decided to, because we were, it was based out of Fishers, but we were doing shows in Carmel and Lawrence and, you know, that nickel plate player's name is most often associated with Fishers. So we wanted to do something that was a little bit more broad, but still keep that that vision that we had. Mm-hmm. So we were kind of surprised the Indiana Theater Company hadn't already been taken by somebody. So we snatched it up and yeah, so but a lot of it is still about you know, promoting new works. You know, if it's not something original, at least a lesser known production. Like we have something in the works by a playwright maybe next season from New Zealand. So yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right. And you do have an upcoming production, The Masks We Wear. What's mm-hmm. that about?
So The Masks We Wear was kind of funnily enough, it was originally my college capstone project at Ball State. And the show itself is, it's aimed at trying to foster a more informed conversation about mental health, specifically the realities of living with anxiety and depression. And it does that through, we call the show a theatrical expose. And that's because the original production was very much a traditional cabaret. You know, vocalist singing, some dialogue in between, pretty much it. However, this production is slightly different. Much like the original production, we still have 8 vocalists, including myself. But we've added some small vignettes in between some of the songs. We have some lighting effects we're planning on doing. So it's a little more beefed up, if you will. Mm. But we found that, so that doesn't really fit the idea of a traditional cabaret, but it's not really a full musical, so we needed something else. And we realized, you know, when something is considered an expose, the definition is it's to lay something bare. And that's what we really want to do with the show, is to lay bare the realities of living with anxiety or depression or any mental disorder, any mental health disorder. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, the show is aimed at trying to inform people about the realities of these issues and hopefully banish the stigmas that surround them.
Yeah, that was kind of my second question. Why is it so important to have these discussions about mental health disorders?
So I think particularly in the U.S., there is a very negative stigma around mental health. And that's persisted for centuries, to put it bluntly. I mean, if you want some more hard dates. People were being put into what they called correctional facilities, in other words, asylums, for the smallest things. You know, it could be maybe there's some slight anxiety, maybe there's some slight depression, but depending on the year, obviously, if a woman was reading a book, she could be put in an asylum. That was considered mentally unstable. And those negative perceptions of mental health have continued from there. We have admittedly gotten better about treating mental health disorders and approaching it, but we haven't really gotten better about actually talking about them. There's this thought, I think, on both sides, both for those who suffer from mental health disorders and those who don't, of fear. There's a fear for those who suffer of being not prejudiced, but
kind of alienated.
Yeah, there's a fear of alienation. There's a fear of being just made a social outcast for something that they were born with. They did not choose this. It was forced on them. And then there's a fear for those who do not suffer, who do not understand these disorders, of the people who have the disorders because of the negative societal stigmas that have surrounded them for so long. You know, essentially, there's the thought of, like, if you have, you know, disorder X, oh gosh, you're crazy. You could snap at any time. When in reality, that's not the truth. Mm-hmm. So I think, particularly in today's day and age, you know, in the wake of the latest school shooting, Stoneman Douglas, yes, mm-hmm. Pardon me for forgetting the exact name. I do remember Stone and Douglas being in there. But, there's been the question about the mental health aspect of it, let alone the gun control side of it. But I think we're seeing more and more issues of people who need treatment, but are often cast aside by society, and so what could be a fairly minor issue just escalates and escalates and escalates, and just gets to the point where the only way to help them is for them to wind up in prison, which is not a way to fix the problem or to even help it, I should say. It's just going to exacerbate things.
Mm. All right. And you've taken kind of a big role with this production. You're writer, actor, and director. Mm-hmm. How are you kind of balancing all three?
Well, I've got a great crew.
A great assistant director.
Well, let's not go that far. No, but in all seriousness, I do have a great crew. I have a great cast. So the nice thing is for me, I performed in the original production in the Capstone Project, so I've done it before. Mm-hmm. And the show, for the most part, was already written when I presented it to Ashton and to Aaron and to Sam, so the rest of ITC. Mm-hmm. There were some minor tweaks that had to be made, but the nice thing was it was pretty much done. But in balancing the director side of things and the actor side of things, as well as my other responsibilities with ITC, because I'm also the technical media director, so website, video, you know, all that stuff that's on my plate. But I have a great crew who's, if there's anything I need help with, I just say, hey, can you do this? And they say, yeah, just tell me what I need to do.
So you did write this when you were in college?
Yes.
What was your inspiration?
So back in 2015, well, it wasn't even really 2015. It was probably late 2014. I was in it wasn't a relationship, so it was a friendship. So we'll call it a toxic friendship. It was just really bad. And I came to find out that I actually have an anxiety disorder. Now, mine is actually pretty mild. I don't take any medication. I don't go to any kind of therapy. Mine's really minor. It's mostly me sitting there telling my mind to be quiet. But as I started to kind of come to understand my own issues, I noticed how a lot of my family and a lot of friends were posting on Facebook about anxiety, or, you know, I was noticing it more in day-to-day conversations. And then at the same time, I started seeing a lot of conversations, a lot of posts about depression. And so I did a little digging, and I found out that the two tend to go hand in hand. But I also noticed, maybe because I actually realized that I was now, you know, in the group of people who were suffering, if you will, I was noticing that call for compassion, that call for understanding, because there was and still is such a lack of understanding. And at the time, I was trying to figure out, you know, I was going from junior year into senior year. What am I going to do for my capstone? I actually had to do two capstones. I was a triple major. But so I was like, all right, I know I have to do something for this, but what do I do for this one? And I came to the idea that I wanted to address this problem. And I found that doing a cabaret or cabaret-style show was the best outlet for it. I thought a film... At the time, I just didn't have time to do a film. I felt like that live interaction, that live setting, was more conducive to the conversation.
Okay. So. And when you were at Ball State, did you do anything else in the theater department?
Oh, yeah. So, like I said, I was a triple major. Mm-hmm. I was a theatrical studies major, a video production major, and a French major. Within the theater department, I was fairly active in Alpha Psi Omega, which is the theater honorary society there. I was in two departmental productions. My junior year, I was in a production of The Crucible, which was directed by Eva Patton. And then my senior year, I was in a production of House of Blue Leaves, which was directed by Mike Dane. I also did a production at Muncie Civic. I was in a production of Annie there, also directed by Mike Dane.
Okay.
So yeah, I was fairly active in the theater department, on several different fronts.
Mm. Right, and have you always been interested in theater?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, when I was a really small boy, I wanted to grow up and become a veterinarian. I even not really interned, but volunteered at a clinic the summer before high school. And, you know, before I had done some school shows before then, like Christmas pageants and things like that, but didn't really get involved into the theater until high school. My older brother kind of talked me into it. And I also started doing speech and debate, which, you know, a lot of people know the debate side, but with speech, you know, that it's basically competitive acting as well. And I decided I didn't want to make money for a living, so I I went to IU and became a long story, but a theater and criminal justice major with a business minor. So
it's an interesting combination.
Yeah,
I found that out about you, and I sat there and went, wait, criminal justice?
Yeah. Well, basically, I went in with theater and business, and you know, so I could have the passion with the practical and. Didn't realize that basically none of my classes counted towards both majors. So I was going into my spring semester of sophomore year and still signing up for freshman accounting. And, you know, I was doing 17 or 18 credit hours a semester and still looked like I was going to be there for 6 or 7 years. So at the time, I was doing a criminal justice minor just because it was something that was kind of interesting to me. So I flip-flopped the two. But yeah, so I, you know, I've been acting professionally for about 10 years now, and I have more stage training. But then once I got out of school, you know, I would still do some sketch comedy, variety show type stuff. Like I was involved with Encyclopedia Show in Indianapolis, which went for several years. A sketch comedy show called The Drink and I. Which was a really fun sort of interactive, you know, kind of breaking down the bar scene. But then outside of that, I did a lot more film and commercial work professionally. And it wasn't really until I started getting back involved with Nickel Plate Players, now ITC, that I kind of made my grand return to the stage. So. you know, it's you know, something that if I can, you know, kind of balance the two, that would be perfect, because I do still work on films here and there, and, you know, go for commercial auditions whenever I get them. But it seems like the theater side is definitely picking up more of my free time these days. Mm-hmm. Again.
All right. And kind of returning to the theme of mental health awareness, have you seen any films or productions that have really gotten it right?
Yeah, that's rough. I have a friend that has borderline personality disorder, and she had a huge campaign against what was that?
Split?
Yeah.
Yeah, like, I was going to ask about that one.
Yeah, yep. didn't want people to – I haven't seen it, you know, maybe partly because of her campaign, but also just because I haven't watched movies as much as I used to. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, it does seem like a lot of times they Hollywoodize it, you know.
They vilify mental health.
Yeah.
Or mental health disorders, I should say.
Yeah, I'm sure there's something, though.
Yeah, I mean, in all honesty, I can't think of anything off the top of my head, because most of the ones that I've seen, they wind up vilifying whoever the person might be that is suffering from what, you know, maybe it's borderline personality disorder, maybe it's schizophrenia, you know. I would say that a lot of the films that probably deal with PTSD, they probably get it more or less right, but again, I don't know of any off the top of my head.
Okay.
Unfortunately, but again, I think that's really part of the reason why it's one of the reasons I definitely wanted to take this show out of the realm of academia and make it viewable, make it reachable by the world at large, because there needs to be more of that conversation about the realities of it. Like, we need to remove the vilification, remove the Hollywood, you know, glamour around it, if you will, and look at the people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, again, so the allegory of the masks in the title, remove the mask and look at the person.
Mm-hmm. All right. Did you guys have a chance to watch the Oscars this past weekend?
I did.
We
had rehearsal that night, so I recorded it and watched it the next day.
Yeah. Any surprises?
A lot of times base it kind of on what, you know, what the other award shows do and everything like that. So there weren't really a whole lot. I was a little surprised that Shape of Water ended up winning Best Picture. I don't think that it didn't deserve it. It just seemed like that was a lot more, you know, with the, you know, Guillermo was racking up all the director awards, but it seemed like there were other movies, like, what was it, the Golden Globes maybe gave it to Three Billboards? Is that, so, yeah. My brother is one of these guys that, like, he'll watch every movie, like, once the nominations come out if he hasn't already seen it. And I was talking to him a little bit, and he said that it was picking up steam. So I guess people that are more able to track it closely weren't as surprised by that as I was.
Yeah, I don't think there were any – I mean, I don't think I had any surprises from it. I had really been hoping that Loving Vincent would win Best Animated Feature, but I pretty much knew it was going to go to Coco.
I was hoping it would be La La Land again.
No, I can't say anything against Shape of Water because we, you know, there's a Ball State grad in there, Doug Jones. Say he's my Hollywood hero. Doug, if you're listening to this, hi. I actually got to meet him my senior year.
Awesome.
He came back and did a Q&A during alumni weekend.
Mm-hmm.
And he is the sweetest, kindest, most humble human being you will ever meet. He is wonderful.
All right, getting back to ITC, when does The Masked Wear open and when can people see it?
It runs on March 16th and 17th at 7:30 each night at the Cat and Carmel. It's
254 First Avenue Southwest.
Well, but now I think now it's also called Veterans Way. So there's been some, but it's right in the heart of the Carmel Arts District.
Yeah.
And it runs two nights only. We would love to get to the point where, you know, we can license it for other theater companies to produce. But right now it's just those two nights.
Right. And we're really happy because the production is actually officially endorsed by Mental Health America of Indiana. David Berman, who is their director for development, as well as the director for the Depression and Bipolar Support Alliance, he will actually be on site. He will be giving a short speech prior to the show. And then he'll also be on hand for, like, answering any questions that the audience may have following the show. But we're really happy to have David there to be able to give his speech, to talk about what MHAI does. And also, we actually have a slight, I guess you could kind of say, incentive going. So for any Ball State students or faculty that actually come to the show, if they come to the show and they present their university IDs, I should say, $2 are actually being donated to MHAI. So we're hoping we get a lot of them down from Muncie. And yeah,
we should put out the warning though that it does have some language and content.
Yeah.
So don't bring your 6-year olds. But
yeah,
get a sitter and come see the show.
Yeah, it's definitely not a show for anyone. I would say probably under the age of 16, depending on how liberal you are with what your kids watch. We want those who want to hear the message and understand it, like, come hear the message, you know, join the conversation.
That was film sociology correspondent McKenna Mays speaking with Aaron Hens, the public relations and marketing director, and Adam Allen, the technical media director of the ITC, and their production of The Mask We Wear is happening at the Cat up in Carmel. And you can go to their website for all the information, which is itcindy.com. All right, we are going to take a short break, and when we come back after the break, my talk with Johanna Bloom and Brian Corbin of the Eiljorg Museum with their exhibit, The Real West. So stick around. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD2 The Point and WFYI.org. Welcome back to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD2 The Point and WFYI.org. The music you heard during the break, the main track, the main theme from Anatomy of a Murder by Duke Ellington. Get the soundtrack. It's great. All right, a couple of Blu-ray notes before I get into my Idle Jorg talk. The documentary Deep Sea Blues, done by the fine music filmmaker Robert Muggy, is out on Blu-ray. A week on the legendary rhythm and blues cruise, featuring performances and interviews with the likes of Buckwheat Zydeco, Bobby Rush, Kim Wilson, Mitch Woods, Taj Mahal, a slew of fine musicians. There's also a bonus documentary called All Jams on Deck, which is about the jam sessions that happen on the Rhythm and Blues Cruise. So go check that out. And also, courtesy of MVD Visual, the 1982 film The Aftermath, actually shot in 1978 and took 4 years to get finally released, but a post-apocalyptic look of an astronaut back on Earth after a nuclear holocaust, and the bad guy is Sid Haig. It's for production value, it's not bad. You shoot it out near the water and out in the desert. Really distracting film score. But yeah, if you're into post-apocalyptic, you might want to check this out. All right, with that in mind, shifting gears, here is my chat with Johanna Bloom and Brian Corbin of the Idle Jorg with the exhibit The Real West, R-E-E-L. Enjoy. So when did this exhibit first start?
I've been working on this exhibit for probably about 2 years now. But the idea has been kicking around our heads for a little longer than that, even probably 3-4 years back. Mm-hmm. We start to plan out our exhibits pretty far in advance, but the real work on them is about 2 years out.
I might say there's like a giant wall and there's titles and ideas. And sometimes
it's more a wall in our minds,
okay,
but yes.
Okay, I wasn't sure. It's like the FBI chart. Yeah. You know, kind of. Okay.
There's a pool of ideas we kick around.
So what was the first step when this finally got into the schedule?
Mm-hmm. Well, the first step, we started with actually a lot of brainstorms around the museum, and we did those with all staff. We did them with a lot of our volunteer pools. We actually did them with visitors. And it was basically to sort of collect as many ideas as people wanted to throw out and just kind of all of the different directions we might go with an exhibit about Westerns, because that's a really broad topic. You
right.
can kind of go anywhere with that. And that really sort of got us to a point where we decided the best thing was to actually do a survey of Westerns and really start at the beginning with silent film and come up to the present day.
Mm-hmm. And what did you find out in the staff and volunteer evaluations?
Well, you know, in talking to staff and volunteers and visitors, it was interesting the similarities across all of those different groups. You know, it was really fun to kind of see people kind of capturing those iconic ideas that you associate with Westerns, you know, epic adventure, you know, conflicts between cowboys and native people, you know, the grand Western landscapes, you know, a lot of that really, the stuff you probably think of when you first think of a Western, mm-hmm. definitely came out, but there were also lots of great surprises, you know, and people who were thinking about Westerns in a slightly different way. So like sci-fi Westerns came out of those conversations, or musicals, and mm-hmm. Some of the satire and comedy that's been done with Westerns. And so those are all things that we're then trying to explore in the exhibit as well.
Okay. I will not name this person, but I had a professor, in college that just simply dismissed it as dust and horses. And of course, what often happens is when something you enjoy is dismissed, you counterattack
yeah.
with something. And I think before science fiction, there were also, you could also have morality tales.
Yeah.
And might be a little easier to swallow in Western form. Two great examples are High Noon.
Mm-hmm.
Arthur Miller agrees. And different. But High Noon and something like the Oxbow Incident.
Okay.
So I think where you could get a little, you know, politicizing.
Yeah.
But because
sure.
it is cowboys and, you know, it was a long time ago. That's not happening today.
Well, I don't know right, that it's not happening
well,
today.
That's what I mean. That's,
High Noon's a great example of that, though. And that's, you know, that's interesting that you used the exact phrase morality tales, because that's something that we are absolutely talking about in the exhibit. I mean, I think it would be very hard to deny the fact that Westerns are morality tales.
Yep.
At their core, they're about conflicts between right and wrong. What is it even, you know, what does right mean? What does wrong mean? Is there a right and a wrong? And you can really track that evolution over time as you look at the genre as a whole. And that's one thing that we're, attempting to do in the exhibit is to show those changes over time and to show how Westerns can really say more about the values and sort of cultural morals of the time in which they're created as opposed to the times they're necessarily representing.
Yes.
You know, they say more about the time that they come out of.
So we will cease with the list of actors playing Native Americans and some of our favorite Native American actors: Paul Newman, Burt Lancaster, Martin Landau, Chuck Connors. I know, sorry. But okay, so sounds like there was great feedback. Then was there a dream list of items you could go for and then wind up? And then I'm sure it trickled down to what we have on display.
Yes, exactly. That's pretty much exactly how an exhibit gets put together. You start off with a dream list. These are all the things we'd love to have if we could get them. And then you start actually tracking things down and figuring out, you know, what's even still available, what even still exists, where is it?
So I guess what was the first major catch?
I would say we have a number of objects we're borrowing from the Autry Museum in Los Angeles,
mm-hmm.
and they were the first lender to kind of sign on board with the exhibit. And from them, we're getting stuff like the Lone Ranger's gun belt and one of my personal favorites is this cardboard robot mask from Gene Autry's first starring role in The Phantom Empire from 1935.
Wow.
So, lest you think sci-fi westerns are a new thing, they are not. They have been around since the beginning. Gene Autry's first starring role was in a sci-fi western with killer robots.
Do you remember watching that? Or have you watched it?
Oh,
yet?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay. Absolutely. Many times.
Okay.
It's a wild, wild film. It's a surprising one to watch. You know, it's sort of a mashup of Western and science fiction and, of course, music because it's Gene Autry.
Yeah, that has
cowboy,
to be.
So.
And Angels Baseball. No, that was before that. I know. With that, did that help make getting items a little easier? Because, they did it, then it must be okay.
Yeah, you know, it definitely helps once you've got that first lender on board. You can definitely leverage that to an extent. So we're working with a number of museum collections as well as private collectors to pull together the stuff that's in the exhibit. And, of course, you know, there are things we weren't able to find, you know, things we hoped we would get that
sure.
just either don't exist anymore. We were never able to find where they live now. But we do have some really incredible stuff. It's a very full exhibit.
So what are some of the items that are in exhibit? Good setup there.
Sure, yeah. Let's see. We've got one of John Wayne's shirts from The Searchers. If anybody remembers the checkered shirt he wears towards the end of the film.
Oh, okay.
That was a pretty exciting get. There's costumes from Silverado, one of my personal favorite Westerns.
I have that on Blu-ray, and I'm probably going to watch it once the Western play I'm working on is done.
Yeah, it's one of my all-time faves. We have one of Stella's costumes, played by Linda Hunt, and then Hat and Boots, worn by Danny Glover in that film. And then we have, from some newer films, which I think might surprise people a little bit, and I think are also sort of an exciting and important thing to include in an exhibit like this. We've got costumes from, or a costume from the Coen Brothers remake of True Grit. We have Haley Steinfeld's costume as Maddie Ross.
Really?
We have Javier Bardem's costume from No Country for Old Men as Anton Chigurh, including the cattle killer, which is, that
no,
was pretty...
you do. Do you have, really?
We really do. It's really cool.
Okay, I'm going to ask this, even though there are people present and listening to this. Did you try it out? Not on a person, but on a block of wood. No?
No?
Nobody shot it?
No, that's not allowed.
Okay, it was worth a shot, so to speak. Wow.
Yeah.
So it's all right, so you bring up No Country for Old Men because it is kind of the Coen's version of a quote-unquote Western. It doesn't, just because it's not set in the quote-unquote Old West.
Yeah,
But it does have that Western feel.
And I think that's a really important point that we're trying to make in the exhibit, is that Westerns aren't necessarily bound by a particular time period. You know, they're not something that has to take place in the past or even the distant past, because, you know, you could even say No Country does take place in the past. It's just recent past.
Right.
But I think, you know, it's almost more that Westerns are capturing an environment or an atmosphere, a feeling. And one of the things that I think is really important about No Country as part of the Western genre is it's an extension of that revisionist approach to Westerns, mm-hmm. and that sort of recasting the West itself as a player within these stories, you know, that a lot of the traditional Westerns, the older Westerns, and even some, you know, newer ones, sort of present the West as this place where you can find redemption or you can, you know, find justice and that sort of thing. And revisionist Westerns really counter that and say the West can be as bleak and as dark as anywhere mm-hmm. else. And No Country really sort of feeds into that. I think it's a natural extension of that.
It's reminiscent of, I think, of the Westerns of Sam Peckinpah.
Yeah.
Where the times they are changing. And like The Wild Bunch, like mm-hmm. Ballad of Cable Hogue, and to a certain degree, Ride the High Country. It's like the West is changing, and we're not necessarily ready to change with those times. And
yeah.
I think No Country for Old Men is it's kind of a the next step in that version. Mm-hmm.
There's no place for right. people like Ed Tom Bell anymore.
Right, and I think people who are angry by the ending of No Country for Old Men, spoiler alert on a decade-old film, but you know it's called that for a reason.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
All right, what else do you have on display?
Oh, gosh, let's see. We've got a couple of objects from some Quentin Tarantino films. That's another
from
exciting.
Django?
We have Django's hat from Django
really?
Unchained.
Really? Okay.
Unchained. And then we also have Jennifer Jason Leigh's hat from Hateful Eight.
Wow.
So a couple of fun recent nods, as well as, let's see, some things from television Westerns. That's
please.
Another kind of section that's represented. We've got a lot of the old classics represented, Gunsmoke, Bonanza, the Annie Oakley TV show, if anybody remembers that
sure,
one.
Sure, sure.
Rawhide. And then we also have some newer contributions like Hell on Wheels and Longmire represented
okay.
as well.
Okay. Did I hear you have something from Catherine Zeta-Jones?
We do.
Did you tell her about my show? Will you please tell her about my shows?
Unfortunately, we did not borrow it directly from her, so she...
See, folks, I tried.
But yeah, we have costumes from The Mask of Zorro and The Legend of Zorro. So we have Antonio Banderas and Catherine Zeta-Jones represented.
There's comments not going there. cool. So, and what else? What else do you have? Before I make you just rattle off the list.
Yeah. I mean, it's such a full show. There's so many exciting things. We've got, you know, Singing Cowboys represented. We've got Roy Rogers and Dale Evans, Gene Autry. We've got children's westerns represented with The Adventures of Rin Tin Tin, Howdy Doody,
okay.
Toy Story even. Let's see what else.
Do you have any blaxploitation westerns? And not counting Quentin. So.
Yeah, no. I mean, Django is definitely.
But you know, Fred Williamson stuff, or even for lack of a better term, there were the black cowboy films of the 40s.
Yes. So we don't have any of the blaxploitation films represented.
Dear Fred Williamson.
We do talk about some of the really early all black cast westerns from even as far back as the 20s.
Right.
And so we, you know, we talk about the Bronze Buckaroo, the Crimson Skull, some other early films. And we don't have objects necessarily for those. But
you're able to acknowledge
yeah,
that.
Yeah, we talk about them in the exhibit. And that's sort of, that's an important point is, you know, for all of the cool objects we do have in the exhibit, there are so many more films that we talk about.
And I'm trying not to get to, it's like here, we're told what shows we don't program.
Yeah.
I understand that. So
yeah.
Is there anything from Italy?
We don't have any objects from any of the spaghetti westerns, but again, we talk about them because you can't yep. not talk
right.
about them.
Right. Great transitional time.
Yeah, exactly. I was kicking off that revisionist Western.
Yes,
kick
back
too.
when the gray hats kind of took over
yeah,
from
absolutely.
Black and white hats.
Absolutely. It's an important sort of blurring of the moral boundaries that had been so much more clear cut up to that point.
Mm-hmm. And also, I'm curious that you talk about like No Country for Old Men, and that's another revision, you know, the term of a revisionist Western. Another one that folks should be aware of course, the 70s cop films. You know, Dirty Harry was
oh,
a
yeah.
Western.
Yeah, I think there's definitely an argument to be made for those. We don't necessarily talk about them, but absolutely. Like, there's so much cross-genre stuff that was happening.
The nerdy film host had the brain.
Yeah,
so,
of
course. but there was, I mean, because, of course, John Wayne was, depending on who you talk to, you know, John Wayne was offered Dirty Harry and turned it down. And then a couple of years later, he wound up doing two urban cop, modern cop films with McHugh
yeah.
and Brannigan.
Mm-hmm.
Granted, he was police officer in his 70s. But anyway, that's kind of what that was. So.
Well, and I think, you know, the importance of Westerns to Clint Eastwood's career, and that, you know, the those archetypes and those roles that he then played, you know, mm-hmm. even worked their way into films that you wouldn't necessarily consider a Western.
I did a research paper. It was probably the best thing I ever wrote in college. I had a film genre class at Ball State, and I did Clint's Westerns because it was the summer Unforgiven had come out.
Oh, yeah.
And so there were three, what I did, I know, four categories. There were the spaghetti Westerns because mm-hmm. that was its own. The other one was called I Ain't Like That Anymore, which was Unforgiven and The Outlaw Josie Wales,
sure.
where, you know, you change from one person to another. The other one I listed, Is He Live or Is He Memorex? High Plains Drifter and Pale Rider.
Pale Rider, yeah.
And then there was the miscellaneous stuff. So that's where I could throw in Joe Kidd and Two Mules for Sister Sarah and Paint Your Wagon.
I don't know where
I don't know where to put that. So just get in there.
Yeah.
So,
Clint Eastwood does a musical.
Yeah, he sang in Honky Tonk Man. Mm-hmm. There's a song in Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil. And if I remember right, I don't think you hear it in the film, but okay. he does accentuate the positive.
Okay.
And I remember he was being interviewed on Fresh Air, and Terry Gross pulled out from the archives. Apparently he recorded an album of cowboy crooning songs while he was working on Rawhide.
You're kidding.
No, so be on the lookout for
amazing.
That. Yeah, so.
So speaking of Clint Eastwood, so
yes.
the two objects we do have representing his career in the exhibit, we have his hat from Rawhide as Rowdy Yates, and then the hat from Pale Rider as Preacher.
Nice.
So, yeah, which is one of my personal favorites of his career.
I was 15 when that came out, and I think I had seen that before I'd seen Shane.
Yeah.
So they're
same.
Well, it's homage, Valentine, ripoff, depending on your optimism. that's connected, though.
Yeah.
Okay, another subgenre, and again, I'm not asking if this is on display or not, but there's also a connection between the Westerns and samurai.
I'm so glad you brought that up.
Well, that's what I was hoping so. So I'll follow. You run.
unfortunately, it's not something we explore in a lot of depth in the exhibit.
But you're very excited about the seven.
But it's a real thing. Yeah, no, it's absolutely, you know, the parallels. And I always like to talk about Western, samurai film, and science fiction kind of together.
Okay.
Because there's a lot that they have contributed to one another, and they, you know, influenced each other. The biggest example of that, the one that, you know, most people will talk about when you're thinking about Westerns and samurai film, is The Magnificent Seven and Seven Samurai.
Correct.
So we talk about The Magnificent Seven in the exhibit. We don't have any objects for that one, but it's such an important film. And then, of course, the remake that just came out a couple of years ago. Is an important sort of recent contribution to the genre. But what we do have in the exhibit is Yul Brynner's shirt from Westworld.
Nice tie-in with the HBO series.
Yes.
Cool.
For those who don't know, the series is based off of a film that came out in the 70s. And Yul Brynner...
Michael Crichton.
Yeah. Michael Crichton story. So Yul Brynner played a character that was just known as the Gunslinger.
And for those watching the HBO series, kind of Ed Harris.
Yeah, well, see, that's the wonderful tie-in. So it's the Man in Black archetype.
There you go.
And it's what's really fun about the 1970s Westworld is that the design and look of that character was a direct homage to his character Chris in The Magnificent Seven. I
mean, everyone's favorite cinematic Cajun and Cajun actor,
yeah.
Yul Brynner.
So he was, you know, he was designed to sort of look and carry himself in a way very similar to this earlier character of his. And then, you know, that whole Man in Black archetype then plays out very differently in the new Magnificent Seven and in the new Westworld.
I showed my buddy Kyle the original Magnificent Seven, and his great comment on Yul was, he leads, when he walks, he leads with his groin. Don't get away with that saying too many times on public radio, but
he does have a very
I think it's his bread and butter after The King and I. You just kind of, you know, you have a positive stance of one way, shape, or form. Are you familiar with that? There was a samurai version of Unforgiven.
No,
with Ken Watanabe.
Really?
Yes.
I have not heard about that.
Warner Brothers put it out. It never came. I don't think it came. Well, it didn't come around here. But there is. I have a Blu-ray of it. I have not watched it yet because I'm praying that it's the correct region.
Okay.
But yeah, there is a version of that.
That's
so
really cool.
And the other one, while we're title dropping, if you're a fan of Star Wars, you should check out The Hidden Fortress.
Okay.
Which is Kurosawa's, another samurai, a Ronin who is going to go after, rescue a kidnapped princess. And then there's two kind of comedic sidekicks who don't necessarily help.
Okay.
So, yeah, you kind of see where that's going a little bit. So.
Well, that's interesting you brought up Star Wars because that's a great example of a film. A lot of people will make arguments that it's a Western, and I think there are arguments to be made.
It is a throwback. First one, 77. I'm not doing episodes with you people, but it is a throwback to the old serial. Raiders of the Lost Ark was probably a more decisive example. Mm-hmm. But you could watch Star Wars, and maybe every 15 or 20 minutes, you can go. You'd have to come back next week.
Yeah. It absolutely owes a lot to the samurai film genre as well. Mm-hmm. It's a great example of how those three things are all tied up together.
So how long is the exhibit going to be in town?
Well, that's a really exciting thing. This is actually going to be up for a year. Opening in March and then closing next February.
Okay, I should go back a little bit. So is there an aspect of the images of Native Americans on display as well?
Yes. Yes, that is definitely. I mean,
sorry, I want to make sure I got that. Sorry. I'm sorry I came this late.
That's, of course, something that we're going to be talking about. In fact, one of the core themes to the exhibit is diversity and representation in Westerns and looking at how.
More than just Paul Newman, Burt Lancaster.
Exactly. Yeah. And looking at how Westerns have kind of shaped our perceptions of who has historically lived in the West and who lives there today and who these spaces are for. And so we're looking at, representations of African Americans, of Asians, of women, of LGBTQ people, of Native people.
It's interesting. Yeah, it's interesting when you look at the casting of the remake of The Magnificent Seven.
Yeah.
It's almost like a crime procedure series.
Yeah. Well, it's I think it was an important update.
Yeah.
A necessary update for the times. And so we're talking about those changing representations and particularly, of course, of Native people, and because that's such an important part of Western stories.
Mm-hmm.
And looking at how both the stories told in Westerns and then the actual production of Westerns have been whitewashed over the years too.
Yeah, by said actors we already mentioned from the 50s, 60s, and so on. So okay. And will you be having special events? I know that obviously the opening is the opening, but
yeah.
What is going to be happening to coincide with the display?
Sure. Yeah, we have a really robust schedule of public programs for the whole year. We've got for opening weekend we have a costume designer Kathy Smith coming out. She worked on Dances with Wolves and a number of other Westerns. So she'll be out talking about her work as a costumer. We've got film screenings all year long at the Idols Org and in partnership with some other groups.
Such as?
Oh, Brian, you want to jump in here?
Oh, hello.
Hi. Yes, our opening weekend, March 3rd, we'll have a film screening of Duel at Diablo, starring James Garner and Sidney Poitier.
Yep.
That'll be at 11 a.m. Saturday, March 3rd, opening day. Same day, we will also have a talk from Kathy Smith. She was the award-winning costume designer from Dances with Wolves, and she'll be discussing her experiences there. And then, as Johanna mentioned, throughout the run of the show, we'll have various talks and screenings. On March 31st, we'll have a presentation from Dr. Sue Matheson discussing the films of John Ford. She's a Western film scholar. I'll just briefly tick off the upcoming films.
Please.
Saturday, April 7th, 11 a.m., film screening Tom Horn, starring Steve McQueen.
One of his – I always remember –
very last film.
That and Hunter. I know we're very close. I couldn't remember which one was last. So.
Same day at 1 p.m., Saturday, April 7th, Kirk Ellis. He is an Emmy award-winning writer and co-executive producer of the miniseries Into the West, and he wrote an award-winning script for the episode Hell on Wheels. Then on, skipping ahead to Saturday, June the 2nd, 11 a.m., our film screening that day will be Silverado.
Ah, you're there for that.
Oh, yeah.
Well, you're there for all these, but yeah, I hear you.
And what I'd recommend is if folks go to the Idlejorg Museum's website, www.idlejorg.org, we will have all our events listed, the film screenings, the talks, the other activities, and nearly every weekend there'll be some type of event to coincide with the exhibition, The Real West, that folks can see and enjoy and participate in.
Yeah, we're going to be partnering with the IMAX Theater as well to do a lot of screening, so that list of films is going to be constantly getting updated.
The
as
one down,
added.
Oh, so down, so
yeah,
hello, Craig.
Yeah, thank you, Craig.
So, all right, so I'm going to put you on. So what are some of your guys' favorite Westerns?
Well, Silverado.
Silverado, you've met that. Yeah, I know you.
No surprise there. I'm loving the new Westworld on HBO. I think it's a fantastic addition. I'm also a big fan of, I'm just drawing a blank. Lonesome Dove is another old favorite of mine. I'm also a big fan of like some of the weirder ones, the sci-fi Westerns.
Oh, I was going to say like Lust in the Dust?
No.
No? Do you know what everyone's favorite saloon singer, Divine? And Tab Hunter.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
No, I've not seen that one. But yeah, like the kind of weird Westerns are the ones that I.
One Eye Jacks. No, that's not that weird. Director's weird.
I'll give a quick shout out to a Western that's just opened, Hostiles, with Wes Studi.
Fine
film.
It's Christian Bale. It's Scott Cooper who did Out of the Furnace, Black Mass, Crazy Heart, which got Jeff Bridges Oscar.
Yeah.
It reminds me of The Searchers a little bit as far as, well, there's going to be some major racial tension on the board for this, as well as The Trip, having to transport Studi's character back, and complications will ensue.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah,
literal and metaphorical journey.
Right.
It encompasses a lot of those themes of transformation that you see in older classic Westerns.
Slightly racist protagonist.
Again, like the
Right, so kind of like, so yeah, exactly. Right. So
Rosamund Pike, very good in that film. Wes Studi, very good in that film.
Yep.
And surprisingly little dialogue. But all three lead actors are so skilled that they really
make
carry the story.
Yep. Well, I remember I did a research paper on Clint Eastwood Westerns in college, and my roommate, I remember I was watching High Plains Drifter, and yeah, within the first 5 minutes, she leans over and says, they're not saying anything. That happens. Or one year, Clint was at the Academy Awards, and apparently Charlton Heston had car trouble, so he was supposed to present something, and he goes up and explains this, and they go, this is like, I think, 71 or like early 70s. So who did they get? They got the guy who said six words in his last five films, and I have to do this. So anyway, that's Babylon here. So, well, cool. And where can people go for more information about the exhibit and everything else, all things Idlejorg?
The website, yeah, idlejorg.org.
Silent breed is people!
Zardoz has spoken.
Go see a good movie. You deserve it. There's plenty out there, and they're also on video. You also have the Real West exhibit at the Idlejorg and The Mask We Wear next weekend at The Cat up in Carmel. Thanks for listening. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD to the Point and WFYI.org. Good afternoon, California. Good afternoon, Fort Myers. Good afternoon, Michigan. Salute, David Ogden Stiers.
I can't believe you let her watch Manos. Is she scarred for life?
Let's put it this way.
What parent are you?
When I wake her up, I vocalize the theme to wake her up to get her ready to school.
Oh, you're a terrible father.
We'll do it live.
Okay.
We'll do it live!